นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะมุตถังธัมมังสังฆังนมัสสามิSo here we are, another night, another evening, practicing meditation in the monastery. All of us coming from slightly different places, if not radically different places, and we have lots of different histories, different personalities.Different situations, lots of differences. And we come together and practice meditation, which in its essence, its essential qualities, is pretty much the same for all of us in its dynamics, which is a wonderful thing. It means we can help each other with our, mutually supporting each other in our Dhamma practice.Even though we might be very different and might be going through different obstructions, different problems, yet the dynamics of the problem, as it were, the problem the Buddha focused on, the problem of suffering, and happiness and release from that suffering, is one we all share.And in its essence, the problem is the same. And so coming into meditation, I find that it is more like coming back to the essence of myself, to use language that way. Of course, the more we look at it, the more we start to see the whole sense of self in a different way, and believe in it less and less.But it feels like coming back to the essence, coming back to the mind itself. And in that space, we share common ground. The phrase is there in Dhamma practice communities in Asia. You often hear that we're brothers and sisters in suffering, which might sound like a depressing thing to say, but...In its effect, on my heart at least, it's an uplifting, has an uplifting effect in that it reminds me that the, my basic experience as a human being, as a being experiencing the world, is just the same in its...Not in its manifestations, not in the conditions that we experience, but in the dynamic. It's the same as everyone else. And so by remembering the simple practice of meditation, for me, coming back to my mind, I see how my mind, my... thoughts and opinions and views will just continue to go outwards and outwards and focus on the differences, the variety, and start comparing people to each other, to myself, comparing experiences that I have, what I have experienced before to what I'm experiencing now, my...image of what I think it should be like to what it actually is, how I should be to how I am. A lot of comparing, a lot of dividing and discerning. And of course, discernment itself, that which sees the differences and sees things in relation to each other, is important and valuable in Dhamma practice and in life. We need it to get around and survive.And yet if we're not If we don't have wisdom, then it can take us over and get out of control before we ever know it. And so we lose this sense, or at least I do, of first of all remembering and coming from that which is common to all of us, that which we all share. This center of our being, the center of the heart, whatever you want to use words, it's just a way of pointing to that which knows, that which experiences. And that's something many, many of us, and certainly many people in the world, perhaps never really even become very conscious of until some event in our life or some movement that takes us to practice comes along, and we start to see for the first time that there is something deeper than just what our minds make of the world. And so the life that I'm living as I experience it is very much something I'm creating all the time. And that's a very radical idea to some people. To many of us who've been involved with Buddhism, it's not radical at all. It's kind of old hat. But it's easy for it to be an idea, to be a view. Unless we're careful, it can be something which doesn't go as deeply as it can do when we see that I create my reality in terms of the belief that I have in my mind's perceptions, views, opinions, experiences, constantly going on and on. Yes, the mind will do that. It needs to. It's functional. But if I'm not careful, I'll just believe it and it will become my reality. And so I will be me different from you, and me not the way I want to be, and life not the way I want to be, the monastery not the way I want it to be. All of that is true enough in its own sense, but it's not truth with a capital T. So coming into meditation as we do, it gives us a chance, an opportunity to calm down, and the obstructions that we'll experience will be similar. Our minds will tend not to want to calm down. I expect most of us here don't have the opposite problem of the mind suddenly dropping into deep absorptive concentration and getting too concentrated too fast. Usually these days in the world, and for those of us here, it tends to be that it's hard to concentrate. The mind is constantly being stimulated through the senses and particularly through thinking, all the very elaborate and attractive kind of thinking we can do these days, because our society is very sophisticated and we are intelligent people. So we get distracted very easily. And the problem usually coming to meditation then is just calming down and allowing ourselves to watch what's going on. So we have simple exercises, these timeless, age-old meditation techniques of picking an object, choosing a meditation object like the breathing, the breath coming in and going out, or a word which we'll use as a way to mark what's happening, maybe in conjunction with the breathing, like buddho, with bud on the in-breath and to on the out-breath. Or we'll keep our eyes open and look at a spot on the floor or a burning candle. We'll pick something simple, and we'll just try to keep our attention on it as a way to train our minds, because we realize, and for me it was a surprise when I first came to meditation, maybe for everyone it is, that my mind was not under my control. I couldn't just say, right, I'll concentrate and then do it. And that can be something which is very important. It is very important to realize that, and it can be a very surprising realization to many people. And it can be easy to forget that that's actually a very good thing. It's a sign of progress when we realize how little control we actually have over our minds. It means we're getting somewhere. Because before, we were deluded about that. We thought we had more control over ourselves than we actually do. So it's a good thing when you see how little you can actually be the way you want to be. It's actually a good thing, usually, because it's coming out of denial, in a sense, coming out of the image that I create about myself, and I believe in because I'm not mindful enough to see what's happening, and I live my life through that. And so then when I do see, well, I'm not that way, it's an ideal. Things are not that way. It hurts. It doesn't feel good. And it feels like, especially if the image was an image which is one I liked of myself, and the reality is that I'm not that way, it feels like a big disappointment. And so it feels like you're getting worse. So sometimes, it's unfortunate, but sometimes people who come to meditation do have some success in calming down a little bit, and then start to see all the stuff that's there, the emotional stuff, mental problems, neuroses, that was always there all the time before, and yet they never saw it. That certainly was the case for me. So I thought I was going backwards for the first few years when I started meditating, because I felt I was getting worse and worse, more and more scattered, more and more neurotic, more and more unable to deal with my emotions, having difficult emotions that I wasn't even aware of before, because they were somehow unexposed. They were hidden underneath, well, whatever we want to call it, my view of myself. So coming to meditation can be hard. It's like coming out of denial. And yet, of course, as many of us know, it also can be really wonderful, even from the very beginning, because the opportunity to have a taste of peace, of a break from the continuous round of thinking, 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 feeling, 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 thinking, feeling, thinking, feeling, 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 thinking, thinking, and just being in it and being pushed and pulled around. Once we get just even a little taste of a break from that, that kind of peace is a revelation, perhaps, and it's certainly something wonderful, something very pleasant. So that's often why we want to continue. We get a taste of meditation or insight, maybe not even through a traditional meditation technique at first, but some kind of taste of insight or peace, and we realize there's a different way. I'm not in control of my mind, okay, my thinking mind, and yet there is a way. There is a way towards peace from that. It's not a hopeless situation. So then we get interested, at least I got interested in practice, and we're willing to do all kinds of things we wouldn't otherwise be willing to do, like wear a dress if you're a male. I have a set of robes, and I wouldn't be willing to do this, walk around London with a set of robes and a shaven head and no eyebrows, and not have any option to do otherwise. I wouldn't be willing to do this if it wasn't somehow supporting something which is going to yield a benefit which is greater than that which I could get by trying to make my life the way I want it to be in the conventional way. So we put ourselves through this, those of us who join the monastic community, all of us who engage in some way, I suppose, with the traditional forms of Buddhism, like those of you who are here as lay practitioners. We give up something, but bowing is not a natural thing for us to do. A lot of these things are not, they don't even make sense sometimes. And yet, we realize there's a payoff which is possible, which is more valuable than the cost, that which we give up, and that which we have to engage with. Some of the cost is also beneficial, because of course the monastic community in a conventional way provides such a wonderful environment of support for this very difficult practice we do. And if we're careful to remember it, you know, I have to be careful to remember it, because if I'm not, I can forget it. If we're careful to remember that it is, how supportive it is, then it becomes something which is a source for me of profound joy, gratitude all the time to be here. I could be many other places, and in some way, some parts of my mind and personality would very much like to be doing those things rather than this. But the heart, here, that which gets touched when the mind is peaceful, that, from that place, I so much appreciate the opportunity to do this practice in a supportive environment and with people, all of you, who are also supporting me in my practice. And so all of us supporting each other, it's a rare situation, as all of us know. So there's a cost, there's a weirdness to it, the sort of whole pageant of it, the uniforms and the traditions and the rituals. And then there's also a wonderful payoff, just being here in a conventional sense. And I suppose then what I'm finding myself talking about or pointing to in this talk is that the payoff, which is sort of with a capital P, that's long more than the payoff we get conventionally, being supported emotionally and physically, being here and socially, personally, but that which can really come from our practice if we commit ourselves to it. The benefits, the results of Dhamma practice, whether we're monks, nuns, anagarikas, anagarikas, lay people, whoever we are, all of us have exactly the same opportunity in this sense. Is that, and we face the same problem. We're brothers and sisters in suffering. We're beings in suffering, all one in this. No divisions. There is the mind, the heart, in what it gets caught up in, and how that all happens. The dynamic is the same. And the Buddha is then called the universal doctor. You know, the kind of, it's the medicine which will cure all ills for everyone, because it comes to the heart of it. And for me, it's been very useful to always remember this dynamic of how my world is created right here, right in the center, right where the mind is. At least in Thailand, they point to the heart when they say the mind. And the thinking, my thinking is what tends to take me away, all the six senses of we have in Buddhism, the five normal senses of feeling and smelling, hearing and seeing, tasting. These can pull us away. We can certainly explore being pulled away by taste during the meal times every day if we wish to. What we see, what we hear. But the thinking mind is the sixth sense. And it's really, for me, the what I have to be very careful to watch. So there's all that my mind is doing with what's coming in, creating my world, me and you, Amaravati, the history of it, the future, speculation, what's going to happen, what has happened, the stories of the past, speculations of the future, all of that is always happening, and it's always happening now. So for me, one of the great wonders, benefits of these very simple meditation practices we have of just following a object like the breath is it teaches us to be in the present moment, to be conscious always in the present. So whatever the value of our histories, and it's not to try to dismiss the value of our personal history or who we are or emotional, the complexity of our emotional world, but it can be simplified always to seeing what it is now in this moment as it is. And for me, the benefit of just a simple meditation practice on the breath is that it has taught me that by staying truly in the present, deeply in the present, I have the opportunity not to follow the mind, not to follow the senses as it pulls me out, as they pull me out. There's what we call papancha, a proliferation, a creation of stories, creation of perceptions that's constantly going on. And if we learn to see it, and this is why we have to practice, I think most of us do, certainly I do, with these formal meditation times. We have to practice sitting and watching, because it's hard to see normally when we're active. But if we do see it as it's happening, then we have a kind of key to being able to let go or keep hands off before we hold on to thoughts as they arise, feelings, perceptions as they arise. We see them for what they are, and they're there. We don't have to suppress them, don't have to run away from them. The ideas I have about myself, even if they're completely deluded, no problem. As long as I see what's happening in the present moment for what it is, I'm not believing in it. I'm not creating a whole world out of that deluded idea. I'm here, I see, deluded idea. And then I'm here again in the next moment, and the next thought comes. So we practice this, staying with the breath, staying with the meditation object, so that we can more and more get in touch, I suppose, with that which can see the thoughts arise, can see the feelings arise, and more trust that which knows, so that we can stay centered in it throughout more of our experience, and in that way bring more of our lives into that centeredness. Or you could put it the other way around, bring our meditation out into more of our lives. And it's very, very easy to forget. All of us do it all the time. And so for me, the benefits of having just an ordinary, nothing special lifestyle, is one of the great aspects of the monastic life, is that we don't try to make it too special, too much variety, too much going on. It tends to be routine, tends to be repetitive. It's actually sort of boring is good. It's not the normal way of the world where you're trying to constantly make things interesting. Actually, boring is good, because then I'm reminded what I'm doing. I'm not trying to get involved, fascinated and interested in all this. I'm hoping to use my life here, the routine of it, the getting up, coming to morning puja, going to the toilet, eating my meals, talking to somebody, going back to my room, or sitting in meditation in the sala, whatever it is, that is the fodder for practice. It's the stuff that can help me to look at what's going on. How is the mind now? Always in the present. What's being created now? And if I do that enough, then I stay with a certain quietness, which is witnessing me as I live my life, me as I talk to people, me as I talk to myself, me as I work, me as I sit. The creation of the idea of me sitting. All of that starts to get seen more and more, because I'm remembering to use my life here in the monastery not for what it seems to be on the outside, but just boring is good. It's just not what it's about outside, but it's something to help me remember, keep looking inwards, keep looking in, keep staying in the present moment, so that eventually that whole division of inside and outside starts to fall away too. Because of course the world that we experience is something that we're experiencing in the heart as a perception. And so you hear this phrase sometimes translated as, you know, the world ends, the end of the world is the Dhamma practice leads to the end of the world. And there's a little booklet that was translated by Ajahn Jayasaro from Ajahn Tet in Thailand called Only the World Ends. And if we don't understand Dhamma practice, you can think, oh, right, well, okay, only the world ends. But when you do start to see this dynamic, it starts to make more sense. When the world, as it's created through my mind's perceptions, feelings, views, opinions, stories, past, future, all of that, it starts to get less and less tasty, more boring itself, because of its repetitiveness. It just never lets you go. It goes on and on and on. And through meditation practice or Dhamma practice, we see there is another way. There's a way out. It is against the stream of habit to be involved in creating the world and being somebody and making it better and making myself better and the whole project of my life and the world. But when we start to see how that is, that it's a trick. It's a trick which will continue to take us into suffering. And that the greatest help we can give ourselves and others is to find a way to release ourselves from that. Then the end of the world, the end is in the end of belief in that, identification with that, the end of involvement in it. And it's a relief in the same way that when we get our first taste of concentration, the first taste of insight, the taste of it, for me at least, is a taste of relief, release, and it's already all okay. The whole project of it, you see, that's the delusion of my mind. It's already, freedom is already here. It's a release, a sense of relief. And that is available to all of us all the time, whether monk, nun, layperson, whomever, if we learn. And so we help ourselves, we help each other to try to remind ourselves this is the project of it, isn't it? Dhamma practice does go against the stream of the world. It's not so that I become a better person. We build the best monastery in the world and we get the best sort of routine here and all the things the way we want them to be and everybody's helped. All of that is good for what it is. It's not that we don't do that either. But that's still caught in the story of the world. And what will be of most benefit will be learning the way out, the way of release. So I have to remind myself of that, because it can become just an idea, and then when it becomes an idea, it gets forgotten as practice. And then when I taste the practice again, it's always such a relief in one sense, because you're right there again. You're just as present as you're ever going to be in this moment. You can't be more. You can't not be as present now as you're going to be once you develop your Dhamma practice in the future. You can be just as present now as you ever will be, even when you're an arahant. Presence is possible. And seeing the mind in its stories is a dynamic we can learn to do all the time. More and more, if we start to commit ourselves to this, then it becomes more possible. And we stop living, or at least stop believing as much in our stories. I can work myself up, if I'm not careful, about all kinds of things that haven't happened yet. You know, there's this, the old story of, at least in America we have this story. I think it's an American story, because in my consciousness it's somebody who's broken, their car has broken down in New Hampshire. And New Hampshire is one of these sort of wilderness states in the Northeast. And it's the nighttime and it's a flat tire, I guess. And he realizes he doesn't have a tire iron. He left it at home, and so he has to change the tire. He has a spare tire. He just needs a tire iron. And he sees there's a light in the distance. There's a house. People are still up. So he walks to the house to borrow a tire iron, which everyone who has a car will have. And of course, people in New Hampshire tend to have all kinds of tools anyway, because they tend to be in the farming business, And the image of a New Hampshire house is one with a tractor and different kinds of tools and so on. And so he imagines how he's going to explain himself showing up out of the darkness in the middle of the night when he knocks on the door. So he rehearses it through his, as he's walking along, saying, "Okay, I'm sorry, you know, my car's broken down. I know you can't see it. It's just down the road, but can I borrow your tire iron?" And, you know, hopefully they'll believe me, because, you know, maybe they'll think I'm lying, you know, and will actually want to steal their tire iron. So I'll have to convince them that I'm genuine. Well, I have my driver's license, but these country people, they can be distrustful of city folk like me. They might see that I have all these clothes on from the city and not want to even lend me their tire iron. In fact, sometimes, you know, people told me the story of some of these country folk. They like to get money out of the city folk because they feel we're all rich. So maybe they might ask for money just to borrow the tire iron. And all they want to do is borrow it. It's just for a few minutes, you know. I mean, it would be silly to ask me for money for this tire iron. And starts working himself up into a whole state of anxiety and anger, and outrage over how could somebody even think of making a problem for me. I'm in need. I need help, and I've broken down. And so he finally gets to the door and knocks on the door, and the kind of pleasant-looking man opens the door and answers. He says, yes. And he says, you can keep your bleeping tire iron, and kind of marches away in a huff. So I notice I can actually do that too these days if I'm not careful. With some of the things I can start thinking about, oh my God, what's going to happen, and this and that, and how could that person, I heard so-and-so, and this and that. And there was recently something about the insurance and all these, for me, outrageous child protection laws that are coming in, and having to think about criminal records checks and fingerprints just to have children in the sala. And I started working myself up into quite a state, actually. I had to see what was going on. So, wait, we haven't even met about this. I don't know the facts. We'll see. Okay, calm down. So I was just like that man walking to that New Hampshire house. So all of us, aren't we, in a way, are like this all the time. We're living in our stories. A lot of it's not even real. It's coming, if we have anxiety, then the stories will form themselves around anxiety. If we have vulnerability, the stories will form themselves around our vulnerability, our anger. They'll form themselves around the anger. Which is, again, another reason why it's so important, in addition to meditation and awareness, to cultivate the divine abidings, the pure states of heart, which come when the mind is clear, of loving kindness and of compassion and joy in the happiness of others and equanimity. Because when we do work in that way, emotionally, with ourselves in our practice, then even the stories, when we do forget ourselves and get deluded, will tend to be affected by less toxic emotions. So there'll be nicer stories. And our delusions will cause us and others less harm. And that's not to say that the divine abidings are in any way deluded. To me, the purity of the heart, when we remove the obstructions and the delusions, the natural expression of a heart at rest is through what we call loving kindness and compassion, that which feels the pain of others. Loving kindness cares about others and about ourselves, all beings, even rats and wasps, all beings everywhere and that we meet. We feel their pain, we care for them, and we're happy when they have happiness, and we're not happy when they don't have happiness. And yet, with wisdom, then there can come equanimity, the last of the divine abidings, which is called upekkha. And it's hard sometimes for us to understand when we look at things from a worldly perspective, especially the way that we've been trained to think in the West. Upekkha seems like not caring. It's equanimity in the face of all the suffering that is real, is part of what is real. And it's something which necessarily comes from wisdom, when we do really for ourselves start to experience that which can release the mind and its stories, and how that takes us into suffering, holding on an identification with the cravings that we have for the senses, the world of the senses, the pulling towards us of lobha or greed, I want, pushing away of dosa, I don't want, shouldn't be, and the wishing it just would expire, just don't want any of it, the delusion of dosa, I'm getting all mixed up now, of moha. This is something which we use the ideas, don't we, to try to get a feeling for what they mean, and yet as long as they're ideas, they won't really penetrate. We need to find a way to find the truth of this for ourselves, and we'll express it in our own language. Maybe it'll be silent, maybe we won't tell anybody. It'll be something which will mean more to us than anything else, I think. It's what keeps me here, and it's something that we all have the opportunity to share together in our different, unique ways. because we are different. And while time itself is a creation of the mind and its perceptions, and we would do well to be wary of getting caught up in its stories, the stories of the past and what happened in the past and the future, what's going to happen in the future, at the same time, we do share a story together and can use that as a way to support each other if we're careful to do so. We can also use it as a way to divide. And so we have a time now of change in the community. This whole year is one which is just one of those phases in life. We have phases in individual's life, don't we, where there's times of change. Sometimes they're expected, often they're unexpected. And times in the life of a community where there is a transition, sometimes expected, sometimes unexpected. And for me, the main thing to keep focusing on is the present moment right now and how I am with what is now and who I'm with now. Not to get caught up in the stories of the past or the fears or hopes of the future. Not to dismiss them either, because part of what's happening now is the reverberations and karma of what has happened in the past. But to always make sure I'm focusing now. What is the reality now, and how can I be with myself and all of those around me and the world as I'm creating it now? How can I be with all of this now in the most beneficial way, from a pace of Dhamma, of release and care, compassion, and if possible wisdom, as a way to release myself from my own stories? And then the beauty of the Dhamma, that whole wonderful phrase, the Dhamma is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, beautiful in the end. Because even at the beginning, even if we're just starting this, we all have, each of us has just as much possibility to reach this point of release in the moment now. And so if these words have been of help, I offer them for reflection this evening.
Andamayam dhamma kataya sarukaram dharam maase.